course, that topic is always an important one, but I think at this moment it's a particularly timely one. If you've been following the news at all, you'll see that there is appeared to be increasing pressure from China on cross-strait relations, and it's been featured in The Economist, Washington Post. Everybody is asking the question, what does this mean for U.S.-China relations, but also, of course, cross-strait and for Taiwan. We have assembled a distinguished group of experts to help us think through this and speculate about the trends and prospects ahead. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Ed McCord, who needs no introduction, just in case. He is a professor of history and international relations at DW, and he also he was also the former vice dean and runs something called the Taiwan Education Research Program, TERP, not to be mistaken for the UNB TERP. But, okay, Ed.
Okay.
Thank you for coming.
I am pleased to see how many people brave their way through the nasty weather today. All the schools are closing, but obviously GW is not closed. Just to warn you in advance, it's just like we had to wait for the previous group to get done at exactly 12:30 to move in. We have another group coming in at 2 o'clock. So that puts certain pressure on our speakers to keep their talks brief and make sure that you have the questions at some point right before 2 o'clock. I'll kick you all out. So I'm not trying to be rude, but we have to keep this machine running. And we have a very interesting talk today. And actually, something I think about the cross-strait relations, I think of this as a patient that has a chronic disease, right? That is basically in remission, and it's kind of okay. But you're always watching it to see, is the treatment working? Has some new complication developed? And that's what we're doing today. We're taking stock. We're going back to the examination room to see what the relationship between cross-strait relations are now. And we have three excellent speakers here that I think are really going to help, because they're going to be able to look at this from three different perspectives. And you all have their resumes, so I'm not going to talk too much about them individually. I'll just introduce them. But we're very happy to have Mark Stokes here, who's the executive director of the Project 2049 Institute, who has a wide range of expertise across public and private sectors. Dr. Joyce Lin, we're very fortunate to have her. She's here for a month of research as a visiting scholar here at the Seeger Center, so we're very happy, and she's an old friend of mine. And she's from Danjiang University, and we've been doing a number of different projects with Danjiang, and I think this is going to help further our relationship with her university as well. But she's also an expert on Southeast Asia, which I think that she's the director of their ASEAN Studies Center, and I think that's really going to give us a perspective that we wouldn't normally have looking at the southbound policy. And another old friend, Shelley Rieger, who's been here numerous times, and we'd like to have her every week if possible, who's a Brown professor at Davidson College and has written numerous books on Taiwan and has a very wide-ranging expertise on East Asia politics. So without further ado, I'm going to turn this over to Mark, and then we'll go one at. I think we'll do all the presentations first, and we'll have collect questions at the end and go from there. So Mark, please.
Oops. Thank you, Dr. McCord. Like the professor said, I also share his our previous introductory speakers with expressing condolences to individuals on Taiwan who've lost their lives due to the most recent earthquake. It's an honor and a pleasure to be talking here today, especially alongside two esteemed professors, Dr. Lin and Dr. Rieger. Great fan of the work. The earthquake in Taiwan is a good reminder about what makes, and this is to borrow a line from Dr. Rieger, why Taiwan matters. Why Taiwan matters has something to do with why Taiwan is unique. There are, on average, a large number of earthquakes on Taiwan that happen every day. Some larger than others, like the most recent one. In 2005, there was a report that was issued, World Economic Forum, I believe, or a UN organization that judged Taiwan as one of the top two most dangerous places on Earth due to natural disasters. if when you look at it from this perspective, natural disaster, earthquakes, typhoons, and then flooding, if you look at it from this perspective, Taiwan has done remarkably well about mitigating some of these disasters. To where if there's a typhoon that happens here in the U.S., whether it's New Orleans or others, it is a big deal just because we're not used to dealing with these sorts of catastrophes. And Taiwan, they take with stride, have done very well. They have a lot to offer the world, I think. The topic of my presentation today is looking at Chinese strategic pressure and implications for Taiwan, and I would add also for U.S. national interests. Look at strategic pressure. I tend to look at this as sort of coercive behavior, coercion in general, political military coercion. I spent 20 years in the Air Force, and for a while in the 80s and 90s, a big theme in the Air Force was on utility of coercive air power. And there was a model that was established to be able to analyze coercive air power that consists of three components. First component is the end state, exactly when you are applying coercion or defending against coercion, what exactly is that you're trying to achieve in some specificity. On the other end, the third one would be the specific actions that are taken. And in the middle is to be able to link the two is something called the mechanism, which is trying to link an action with what your desired behavior is. And this is the hard part, because sometimes I have evidence in terms of thinking through an action and then how that is supposed to contribute towards your end state. So with that as a preface, I would argue in terms of Beijing's actions, in terms of end state toward Taiwan, there's no question that they're ratcheting up the pressure against administration of Tsai Ing-wen. This is not new, though. I would argue the best place to start with an end state is to sort of get a grasp of what is narrative and what is objective reality. The objective reality is that Taiwan, under its current Republic of China constitution, exists as an independent sovereign state. This may sound shocking to some, but this is objective reality. The objective reality is different from how, for example, the United States deals with it, and how, whether or not the question whether to recognize Taiwan or ROC or how to deal with it in general. But there are two legitimate governments, and I think former representative Randy Forbes put this best. There, the status quo is the existence of two legitimate governments on both sides of the Taiwan Strait, an autocratic People's Republic of China and a democratic Republic of China. There's nothing inconsistent with having relatively normal relations with both sides of the Taiwan Strait and a one-China policy. One-China could be ill-defined and undefined. We had normal relations with both sides, relatively normal relations with both sides between 1972 and 1979 with a one-China policy. So what could be the end state? What makes this difficult is this runs against, you know, the objective reality runs against PRC policies driven by a framework known as one country, two systems, in which there's one China, Taiwan's part of China, and the PRC is the sole representative of China in the international community. So how do they at least somehow formalize this arrangement with a democratically elected government in Taipei, or sometimes even more importantly, how do they get the rest of the international community to buy into this narrative? How do they formally ensure that the PRC is the sole representative of China, which they believe that Taiwan is part of? And this is the challenge. And this is where the coercive actions come in. Coercion is not just direct cross-strait, but it's also active here in the United States, trying to implement this notion of one China, two governments in all but name internationally, particularly in the United States. We see it on a day-to-day basis. To Beijing, it's a zero-sum game. You cannot, they have a saying, you know, sovereignty cannot be divided and others, that you can't have a win for Taiwan in terms of what some would view as symbolic activities would be viewed as a net loss for authorities in Beijing. This could be all the way, let's say, for example, more recently, the removal of the ROC flag from State Department website. This is an example where it seems symbolic, but it actually is quite meaningful, in my view, as I'll explain later, why this is moving in the wrong direction, why it's counter to U.S. national interests. But let's look a little bit about the three different perspectives, Chinese security perspective, Taiwan security perspective, and U.S. security perspective. There are two different ways to look at what drives Chinese behavior, or course of behavior in particular, in terms of goals vis-a-vis cross-strait goals. One is to look at it from a geostrategic construct. Geostrategic, and that's where you hear terms like first island chain, second island chain, trying to make Taiwan into an unsinkable aircraft carrier. You tend to put things in military terms alone, and put aside other aspects, let's say, for example, political goals, or leveraging economics as an instrument, or leveraging culture as an instrument with the military. On the other hand, you can look at a sort of a driver being political legitimacy. And again, it goes back to that zero-sum game. What is it that they fear, the authorities in Beijing fear about Taiwan and its emerging democracy? Does it have to do with simple legitimacy, that whenever you extend legitimacy to Taiwan or the RFC, that it's a step away, it's a hit against legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party? That's another way. I tend to adhere to the second aspect, legitimacy. Not to say that geostrategy is not a driver, but I think it's important. The PLA plays a role in either case. The PLA and military aspects are an instrument. Bear in mind that the PLA, People's Liberation Army, is an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party. It has a state function, but it's primarily an instrument of the Chinese Communist Party. It's not just a military in the way we think of these things. You can extend this by saying that every military activity has a political implication, a thought through. Coercion is dominant in their thinking, and it has been for decades. It's just now it's been ratcheting up quite a bit. In terms of structure for coercive behavior, we'll get into that in many details, but you can look at it as a system of systems. You have an external affairs system, which would be, of course, you have Ministry of Foreign Affairs, but more important, you would have things like the Central International Liaison Department. They dropped the liaison in their English translation, it has a variety of platforms that they use for people-to-people exchanges. Another thing in the construct, there are three ways to look at this. There's state-to-state relations, people-to-people relations, party-to-party relations, all have a significant role in achieving as part of their statecraft. There's the United Front Work Department, and also the Chinese People's Political Consultative Committee. They have their own platforms, quite active here in the United States, with a whole different forms, a whole range of forms. You also have the propaganda ideology league small group that manages things like a whole range of publications, and also fundamental ideology, as well as the military system. That would be like, for example, the CMC Political Work Department Liaison Bureau, which is very which plays a critical role on more direct military issues. And of course, a growing role for enterprises, all working together in a somewhat coordination fashion to be able to achieve their goals. Again, I would say that goal is trying to affect the one country, two systems framework in all but name, cross-strait and international. Taiwan security perspective, broad range of challenges. The challenge they face from natural disasters is just one, but it's also an opportunity because it gives them a role to play. But how do you maintain a status quo? Status quo, as mentioned before, Taiwan, RFC constitution exists, independent sovereign. How do you manifest this? How do you maintain the pressure that you're under, especially internationally, and also the pressure you're domestically, when you have this these different organizations that are working against you, purposely? There's a set of Tuanjie, Yojun, Wajie, Dijun, basically this idea of where you develop and you create friends for the United Front perspective, so Taiwan, and then purposely trying to inject friction in between, let's say, for example, on Taiwan, within the DPP itself, within the KMT itself, between the KMT and DPP, broader aspects of society, and also even between the United States and Taiwan and other potential supporters around the world. So military, the cross-strait issue is not just a military conflict. It's easy to put it in this perspective because looking at things from a pure military perspective is just easier. But let's say, for example, the challenge they're facing with the recent flight activity, the M503 air route, and also the B6 and the Y8 flights that have been going around Taiwan for the last few years, but increasing in frequency. These, when you go back and look at the 503 issue, it's not new, it goes back to at least 2007. We saw a series of editorials, for example, a big one that showed up at Xinhua, that talked about we need an ADIZ, an Area Defense Identification Zone, eventually made, and then talked about and put it into the specific context of Taiwan. Just imagine, you know, the furor that was that came about after the East China Sea ADIZ. What if they actually established an ADIZ over Taiwan? Because in some ways, that's almost what it seems to be leading toward. And you'll see hints of this in some, I would say, non-authoritative editorials coming out of Beijing. But bottom line is, you'll see language that we use that, for example, the Taiwan Strait is a Chinese sea, it's Chinese waters. Do they mean DRC waters, or is it just some nebulous one, China, metaphysical one, China? But this is something to watch for very carefully. From U.S. perspective, and there are other issues as well, for example, the flag issue. And this is where I'll get into the U.S. Perspective. In my view, the United States has an interest in increasingly in balancing legitimacy on both sides of the Taiwan Strait. If not gradually and without any sudden moves, doing more to be able to, basically to move toward no reason to break down a one-China framework, but certainly to be able to balance legitimacy in terms of how we relate to legitimate governments on both sides, arguably our Taiwan's government in many ways because it has popular sovereignty. In some ways, we seem to be making progress, in other ways, moving back. There are three reasons why I think we should move toward a more normal relationship with both sides of the Taiwan Strait. Reason number one, objective reality. Foreign policy is always best conducted in accordance with objective reality. And ambiguity is fine in some ways, but at least, without saying so, at least what should be driving is be able to move toward a balanced relationship, objective reality. Second reason, right now there is a tendency to share Beijing's views on so-called One China, which is a zero-sum game. You only have normal diplomatic relations with one side, not diplomatic relations with the other. But in effect, what this does is that you're legitimizing an autocratic government. What signals does this send around the rest of the world? Why do you have, for example, Freedom House that talks about democracy backsliding to some extent? This symbolism, you can use symbolism. Symbolism matters. In the Taiwan Strait, symbolism is legitimacy. It is its substance. There's a reason why, for example, there's been a saying in the past, competition at the time between, for example, KMT and the CCP, 70% political, 30% military. That fundamental principle resides until today. The third reason why I think the U.S. should consider doing more to balance relations with both sides of the Taiwan Strait in terms of legitimacy is if we are sincere about wanting to create the conditions, not get in the middle of the relations, but create the conditions to be able to give, for example, the Tsai administration confidence to engage counterparts in Beijing with confidence, then doing more for soft balancing, I think, is very important. It's not just all about arms sales, but it's also about the other things that matter in this. And this goes back, again, to, I think, why the flag issue is important. It seems small, but I think it is critical. There are other things on the defense side that we could be doing. So with that, I'll turn it back over to Professor McCord next week.
First of all, I'd like to thank Professor Edward Marco to invite me to be here and as a panelist and he holder so the significant Taiwan table. And I shall talk about Taiwan's new southbound policy and the China factor. And also I'd like to take the opportunity to thank IPA and reach out their help at a social time and the making efforts to do that. And then if you look at our new southbound policy, today I would like to have my purpose on, I would like to explain Taiwan's new southbound policy and now and how China may affect that policy. And Taiwan has had previous go southward policy in the former president like Li Denghui in 1990s and Chen Shui-bian, and then Ma Ying-jeou, also Tsai Ing-wen. And we all like to know Tsai has again focused the Southeast Asia, South Asia, and Australia, New Zealand, so-called 18 target countries. And Taiwan wants to increase international space through the increasing activities and relations with 18 partner countries. So, as we know, recently, as Mike just mentioned, recently, so many China stepped up pressure on Taiwan. So that will be harmful to the cross-strait relations. And I do believe Beijing continue to squeeze Taiwan's international space, and Beijing has unilaterally launched the new northbound air route, M503. So China and Taiwan continue their T40 struggle in the Taiwan Straits. So today, my main argument will be China's unfriendly attitude will be harmful to cross-strait relations, and Taiwan should maintain its own sovereignty and dignity. Taiwan needs more careful to face the military activities, intelligence gatherings, and code flying bombers from People's Republic of China. And then, as we know, Taiwan's southbound policy include four pillars like international trade cooperation and some civil society's organization to help, and also like social culture. So we can see so many immigrants from Southeast Asia. We have had about 600,000 the so-called immigrants from Southeast Asia, mostly from the Philippines, Indonesia, and Thailand. So these the different period of President Tsai Ing-wen, Ma Ying-jeou, Chen Shui-bian. But about 1.5 years ago, Tsai has proposed the new southbound policy. What's the difference between the two? I think the new from one-way investment to two-way exchange, and then the new goes southbound policy from trade and the economics to diversification and the multilateral exchange, and then it's people-oriented, and then pursuit the new future and the new prosperity with all the 18 countries. So if we know the NSP, so-called, include the five flag industry and agriculture, and also like some educational exchange, so-called 5+2. So Taiwan's soft power in Southeast Asia looks like more and more stronger, and then we can find there's better outcomes than before. So international cooperation and regional, like headquarters, like IC, industry from Taiwan's business and multilateral country that's be more and more stronger. So you can see after Taiwan and Singapore bilateral free trade agreement and Taiwan, New Zealand, we also have some bilateral FTA, free trade agreement between Taiwan and India, Thailand, Vietnam, Malaysia, Singapore, Philippines and Indonesia. That's very clear. And also, we have had accumulated about 600,000 workers from Southeast Asia. And then they will be very friendly people to treat Taiwan. So you can see the second generation in the Tsai Ing-wen's campaign. They also have a very strong support at that time. And then I would like to speak about China factor in Taiwan's new southbound policy. As we know, China keeps to do some specific things to harm Taiwan's international space. And then recently, because Tsai Ing-wen didn't receive the so-called 19-2 consensus, so China seems like not to continue to increase relations with Taiwan, and China is neighboring country to boycott Taiwan's NSP as well. So China also proposed a Belt and Road Initiative and provide so huge money to make it. So you can understand like Guangxi and some big city. If a Taiwanese businessman they don't want to agree with the so-called One China policy, then their business will be become very very difficult. So China has launched One Belt One Road Initiative and ready to put a very huge money, over 1 trillion renminbi, to assist in the development of domestic infrastructure and some business in this so-called over 100 neighboring countries. And then we can also see China now looks forward to achieving the political result with economic strength, so that China repressed Taiwan's NSP to a very considerable extent. And then we can also find that China still faced some problem, like Pakistan, Nepal, and Myanmar successively canceled the three very big project. And both Pakistan and Burma oppose China's behavior and attitude and can represent Nanning in Guangxi province. So if you can look from China and ASEAN, they're having so many problems and difficulties in this region because of more and more South China Sea disputes in this region, and they are having so many artificial reefs in the South China Sea, and then China want to show its muscle about military display, and also I mentioned the Belt and Road Initiative, and then China wants to use his money and make very easy to control this very strong political and economic power in this region. So China would like, together with his President Xi Jinping and Premier Li Keqiang, they have been to all the ASEAN 10 member states to have very high level visit with everyone, national leaders like Aung San Suu Kyi, like Jokowi, and even like Najib, everywhere and every city. Every time national leader will be asked by China to reiterate the principle of the One China principle. Recently, you can learn from the newspaper like Cambodia, Hun Sen, and Laos president, also the president of Vietnam. They also declare they formally and they would like to accept One China policy. So if you look from the Great Mekong regional development, like the GMS project, there have been some trouble, difficulty, and then I will mention later. So if we back to the Taiwan's new southbound policy, Taiwan's business and company, they are almost small and medium enterprise, and we would like to have our prosperity by people to people. And then we must share the resources, and the 80 partner countries want to have a good relations and the people oriented and more, and mutually beneficial in the future. So Taiwan's new southbound policy has had very good outcomes in the last 1.5 years. But still we have some difficulties, like the media or academics in Southeast Asia have not discussed the policy of Taiwan in promoting the new southbound direction drastically, because they knows very few. And as we know, so many, like Indonesia students, Malaysia, they come to Taiwan to have their higher education, but very few Taiwanese students, they want to go to Southeast Asia. As I know, my students, if I suggest, why don't you go overseas to have your higher study? If you go to Washington or New York or like Canada, they say, oh yeah, yeah, no problem. But if you suggest our students, how about go to Vietnam, Manila, or Kuala Lumpur, or they will yeah, keep silent. And after 10 seconds, and they told me, oh, I will go home to discuss with my parents. So that's very different. Yeah. So if you know the Taiwan's new southbound policy, also have some difficulty as well. So as we know, because of time stream, I will go very fast. High education have also exchanged bilaterally and multilaterally at our university. And also, we want to build some regional or international non-governmental organization center, especially in Taichung. And then also, we also have over 40 million overseas Chinese and Taiwanese in Southeast Asia and the world. So the 5+2, there will be more and more prosperous to fulfill our NSP. So Taiwan is also a maritime country, unlike mainland China. So you can see our Taichung mayor, Lin Jialong, he wants to build NGO headquarters, and then our president Yin Wen-Tai also supports his idea. And then the people-oriented and some good so-called flag industrial seems like more and more successful in this region. And you can see our environmental protection like heads in Southeast Asia countries, and we can also have some humanitarian relief and some trafficking act and prevention some yeah, sexual, like yeah, some children's hurt, and then like international act. So Taiwan and ASEAN, Taiwan will be to play a very significant, trustful friend and good neighboring role. And then we can help each other in Southeast Asia, South Asia, and even Australia and New Zealand. So the four pillars of NSP will be like this. I mentioned again, international track, resource sharing, people center, and regional community consensus. And then Taiwan will continually and increasingly engage all ASEAN member states. So you can see that every year we pay attention to the ASEAN summit. And then you can see we also want to cooperate with India and some South Asia countries to help together. So you can see the Modi and all the ASEAN 10 national leaders here. So how's Taiwan future under the NSP policy? We do believe our government and our people will cooperate together, and Taiwan will conquer increasingly pressure from China, and where we will have a good and successfully respond the increasingly military activities and handling power intelligence gatherings and the flying bombers were much closer from PRC. So I would like to have some conclusions. Taiwan and ASEAN, South Asia and Australia, New Zealand, we will become very good friends and neighboring countries. Taiwan can become a very trusted friend and neighbor. Responsible stakeholders, Taiwan can provide meaningful contributions, and we will have some more and more bilateral and multilateral relations, and where we can see the future very bright. Economic community consensus feature in the region. So I think it's timing to engage all the ASEAN member states and all the 18 target countries. So in conclusion, I try to repeat what my purpose, and I'd propose some policy suggestions as the following. Taiwan may join the Indo-Pacific project, which was proposed by the United States, especially President Donald Trump has his first Asia trip last November, and he emphasized this Indo-Pacific project. And then Taiwan would join the new comprehensive progressive Trans-Pacific partnership in the future. And then Taiwan can also consider to apply informal ambassador to ASEAN secretary based in Jakarta, since there have been more than 87 ambassadors in Kuala Lumpur, in Jakarta, Indonesia. And so very important people in the ASEAN secretary, like some deputy secretary, have suggested that why don't you just apply ASEAN plus one, so-called ASEAN plus Taiwan. That's another a new institution arrangement. Then if you put on the this agenda on the table, then ASEAN will have some discussion about this new agenda. So I think another thinking, we can also follow the United States Peace Corps in Asia and the world in the past five decades. Okay, I'd like to stop here. Thank you for attention and welcome comments.